I want to start today's episode by echoing something which Coborn is going to go on about much, much later, and that is we love Filecoin. If you don't know the Filecoin Foundation, they, and this is a gross oversimplification, operate a decentralized storage system for basically everything, blockchain assets and otherwise. I've heard their mission described as, and I'm paraphrasing, wanting to preserve the entire internet, which they actually seem to be doing, having partnered with the Internet Archive. Last year, actually, we received a grant from Filecoin to integrate their storage protocol into all of our tech at the museum, thereby preserving the little slice of internet we at Mocha own and operate, basically creating this eternal register of everything we've ever done or that's been done through us. Every piece in our collections, every varying state of our community collection, which is constantly changing, and every curation that uses any of our tools, be that the scrolling Mocha shows or the 3D Mocha rooms, everything permanently preserved. But what does that mean, really? If we could go back and see the infinitesimal details of the internet as it was at any time, what does that allow? What does that mess with? When the internet remembers better than we do, where does that leave us? These are some of the questions at the heart of today's episode. I've been fascinated for a long time by the implications that might come should we get really, really good at sifting back through endless preserved information. Because yes, there'll be a lot of gunk to push through, but if we can attain a kind of clear and detailed picture of the past, really, really nitty-gritty stuff, we can bypass the bias of primary sources, the skew that comes inevitably when someone tells us a story, any story. In this case, the story will be right there in front of us, telling itself. At the risk of this cold open becoming an exploratory essay in its own right, I'll let today's conversation do the rest of the heavy lifting. On his face, our guest today comes as an emissary of the Filecoin Foundation, but in practice, he reveals himself as so much more. Danny O'Brien is a senior fellow at the Filecoin Foundation, but he's been an internet freedom warrior for more than two decades, and we'll go into all of his accolades in a bit. Danny's massive breadth of knowledge is on full display during our conversation about preservation, internet freedoms, accountability, and a lot more. This conversation brought me out of my depth in the absolute best way possible. Mr. O'Brien is a brilliant, brilliant dude, and I hope you enjoy hearing Coborn and I speak with him on this week's Mocha Live podcast. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Mocha Live podcast. My name is Max Cohen. It is 2:08 p.m. Pacific Standard Time here in rainy but still beautiful Seattle, Washington, and I will be one of your hosts for the Mocha Live podcast today. Joining me, as he does every week for the Mocha Live podcast, my inimitable co-host, Mr. Coborn Bell, the founder of the Museum of Crypto Art. Coborn, how are we finding you today?
Wonderful in snowy New York, enjoying the inside.
All right. We're all inside. We're all happy to be inside. And hopefully our guest is happy to be inside as well. So if you listen or have listened to the podcast for a while or have your finger kind of on the pulse of what we do at Mocha, you know that we're very proud that every piece in our collection, and every curation in a Mocha room is backed up permanently, including its metadata and its file information, by our backend integration with Filecoin. Art Gnome is like the patron saint of warning us that NFTs that are not backed up run the risk of just being permanently lost. We have that happen to us with the Xcopy piece cracked in our own collection. It's just kind of gone because rare.art fell in like 2020. Anyways, there's a lot of like fascinating implications in the kind of preservational ability that blockchain allows us. And our guest today is here to talk about quite a few of them. He is a senior fellow at the Filecoin Foundation, founder of the Open Rights Organization, and an activist for the internet world for quite a long time. That is Mr. Danny O'Brien. Danny, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for being with us.
A pleasure to be here. Inside, as you say, it's freezing in San Francisco where I am. And I know that because our heating isn't quite working. So yeah, I'm happy, but could be happier.
Cool. Yeah, we are all inside. We're all bearded and we're all ready to talk.
Yeah, about. I had to grow this out just to survive in this chilly, chilly environment.
Yeah, we got Danny for the podcast a few days ago and we had a few ground rules. And the first one was like, you got to have no chins.
Got to grow my chin out. a little bit. So yeah.
We appreciate it.
There's nothing there. This is just the whole of my bottom of my skull. What an unpleasant image. Move on.
All right. Let's just jump right in. So something that I've been really aggressively bullish on when thinking about preservation in general is like the near-term future of art history. And I've written a bit about this before because I think it's really fascinating that if, especially with all of this stuff in crypto art and blockchain just preserved right down to the nitty gritty, like momentary curations, like the daily trends, if we can preserve every mint, every collection, every curation and compile it together in a way that's navigable, I think that we will be able to, when looking back on crypto art, understand its minutiae in a way we've never really been able to do with any other kinds of art history, especially because it's so like perspective based. And this is outside of perspective. So I'm curious, Danny, how much value do you see in being able to like get really in depth in the nitty gritty kind of details of an art movement?
Oh, you've totally nailed it. I thought I was going to coast for like 10 to 15 minutes going, oh yeah, storage is important. And like, you've got to like the nub of it immediately, which is that without a trail behind you, you have no way of not only understanding like the past, but like the present, right? Like the two things that people didn't really, and I include myself in this, understand about what it was going to be to live in a at least 50% digital environment with art, without whatever. It was one, the presumption, and this sounds so insane now, but the presumption that because it was digital, it would last forever, right? Mm-hmm. Like in the CD era, like you can look at these freaking you said I could swear, so I'll up my level. These fucking shows when the CD first came out, where people would be going, oh, this baby's going to last forever and we won't have to worry about, you know, paper or album, you know, vinyl decaying. And of course now, like CDs 10 years old, like falling apart in a way that vinyl isn't. So digital and online as well, right? Every one of those web addresses was supposed to be permanent, right? Like the idea is like Tim Berners-Lee would link to something and it would be there forever. And now, you know, the world is full of 404s. So there's that. The second part of it though, is this idea that the more information we would have, we knew that we were gonna be in this sort of weird post-scarcity world of like more art, more music, more knowledge, more,
what? Say it, Colborne.
He loves when I say radical abundance.
There it is.
Okay, well, there you go, right? Like we live in a world in so many ways of radical abundance, but we don't have any way to, like, without navigation, without context, without multiple views on that and a way to pull all of that together, it's just noise, right? It's just like the blurred background, right? And if the only thing that exists is that breaking front of innovation, which is kind of what it feels like right now, like you don't get to understand anything because you just have, you need to be able to like mine and understand this. And like, thank God large language models and AI turned up when they did, because that gives us an opportunity to have some help in this. But as everybody says, right, like, you know, large language models need that context as much as more than we do. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we can drill into kind of, you know, what it means to store an art on IPFS and then back it up onto something on Filecoin or something else. But before we even get into that, the big idea is you have to, like, you the only solution to the amount that we have now, to abundance as we have now, is more abundance. Like it's an endless game to like try and build a context bigger than the world you live in.
Yeah, absolutely. And that like leads into my next question, which is about like the tools we have versus just the back end integrations that we have, right? It's one thing to have a Filecoin, it's one thing to have an IPFS, it's one thing to have, you know, access in perpetuity to all this information. It's another thing to be able to access that information in a flow that feels logical, that feels easy, it's, that feels like, yeah.
Please. It's all user interface, right? This is one of the this is what we're going into now. Kind of, I mean, crypto particularly, right? And sort of Web3, but I think in a lot of other areas too, where it's 99% the usability of it. Like whether it lives or dies, whether people see it or they never see it, whether people click on your work and explore it, it's all down to that. And you know, my beard is grayer than yours, and so but the only insight I have, right, is that was the moment in Web 1 sort of became Web 2, right? Was that we had all of this amazing stuff, but it was just for, you know, nerds or whatever. And then everybody kind of caught on. And this is what took Google, I think, to power, and to a certain extent Amazon too, is they went, and definitely Apple, right? Is they went, oh, but if we make it usable, then the whole world opens up. And the people who didn't have that insight or were all sidelined, including my people, right? Like I'm a free open source, you know, crunchy granola, everybody get back to Usenet kind of guy. And the thing that sidelined that and turned centralized the internet was as much the fact that Apple would concentrate on usability and we would concentrate on, you know, really funky command line, you know, read the man page or whatever. That was the book where we lost control.
Colborn, if you could go through the entirety of your journey in crypto, not even just crypto art, but everything you've done that is blockchain adjacent, what do you think would be the most interesting, like, kinds of information to pick out for you or for anyone?
Oh, to save forever?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just like, you know, Colburn's been collecting stuff since 2018. Am I correct in that? 2019?
Oh, sure. 17?
2017?
Yeah, additional or CryptoKitties came first. We're talking NFTs, Decentraland lands. I don't know. I mean, you go, it's a crazy question, right? Because you begin to think of all your digital interactions, right? And then you begin to ask yourself, what is worth saving? And, you know, maybe what I was doing 20 years ago, like playing, you know, this game, Vagabond's Quest, in which I built this wizard and had all these items. And like hell yes, I would love to have that character and remember, you know, who I was or what I was emulating. But that for me is now just like early internet nostalgia. I don't really know what to say other than, you know, I continue to like marvel at my position of being like half in and half out of the internet and having a childhood without the internet and all of these kind of like passing fleeting things that might have been captured, say, in Super Nintendo or video games or early digital experiences that exist more as nostalgia. And then coming to the point now where you recognize that, okay, like NFT is kind of a file format that can be saved and captured. And
it's a beautiful moment because I think one of the thing that gives art depth to humans is that sensation of, oh, I remember myself and how I felt the first time I saw that. Like people say that like the music that you listen to for the whole of your life is the music that you locked onto when you were a teenager. And you know, no matter how, I mean, people can be much more eclectic than that, right? But like there's definitely, it definitely has a taste, right? And that's one of those things that storing and preserving gives you a feel for, right? And like, to be honest, you know, I feel like much of modern digital art that interests me is about not only kind of playing with the past, right, the recent past, but also kind of past that didn't really exist, or past that I sort of passively knew about. So you said I'm allowed to swear, and I'm not going to use the word, but there's a brilliant TikTok, and like I'll send it to you people later, where somebody, I don't know, kind of like maybe they're maybe 30, it was hard to sort of place their age, but there's talk that they're a game collector, and they're going, why aren't phones as, and she uses the C word, as they were in the 2000s? And I'm like, yeah, that's a good question. And she, you know, she means it in a positive way. And then she goes to talk about, like, this is my, I'm now a professor of C-ology. And like talking about how, like, you know, there were little pink phones and there were little, like, there was just a thing about.
And their names too, the chocolate, the envy, the juke.
Right. So, and like, you know, the thing for me that's sort of interesting, right, is, again, without harping on my age, you know, everybody, the thing that I love talking to people about is like, when did you first experience the internet? Because Colbin, as you said, right, you have that moment. And I'm awaiting the moment where people go, I can't remember, right? Like, I always have my, I was like raised with my iPad. But even so, even if it's just in your background, right, there's going to be a generation of people that were born after NFTs were a thing, right? Or like, you know, live in a world where that is one of the things that they know about. And the thing that is, there is a moment when you come into consciousness with things like that. And in some ways, you're always trying to go back and reconstruct that. I mean, I love the internet. But I love the internet because I was kind of like, it was my thing, right? It was the thing I got to carry on my shoulders when I was like 22, 23 and going, oh, this is the thing that's blossoming at the same time as I did.
Yeah.
And the generation before me were always going on about TV. You know, right. television's really bad for you. Or television is, you know, an amazing art form and will educate the world. And I remember at the time going, well, TV is just that thing that plays in the background. But then I got my own thing. So, yeah. You know, and then it goes away, right? Where are those old TV programs? We almost managed to preserve them, but not all of them.
Well, you know, so I have a couple like parallels to that. You know, my early internet, it was like using StumbleUpon and Omegle, right, in like middle school, right? Which took you necessarily to these like weird corners of the internet that you'd never otherwise visit, right?
Right.
Because you're relying on the randomness of the thing.
Right.
In the same way, I fell in love with movies when I was a teenager because, you know, I would just go click to channel 300 and then have 90 movies on.
Right.
And from there, you know, I would watch the same things over and over again, start to internalize the language, start to internalize the cinematography, start to like, I the references for things that I have no right to be able to understand references, like, to all sorts of movies. Right. And, you know, I watched The Dark Knight. I've probably seen it 250 times because it was always on HBO when I was just flipping through channels.
Right.
And so you have access to weirdness that you know is there, but you can't kind of experience, you know.
Right.
I think a lot about like the monoculture in television of the 70s and 80s, right? Four or five channels, you know, the Cheers finale, I think, is the most watched TV program in history because there was nothing else to watch. That was the thing when it was one of the four programs that was on. And so everyone watched it.
And also, how do you recapture that? Like, you know, when people, you know, it's almost the most boring way, but an important way of like teaching about film history, right? Or something, is they go, well, imagine being in the 1920s and turning up and seeing Charlie Chaplin for the, you know, and they have to contextualize, as you did, right?
Or that story of like the great train robbery, right? That film from like 1907 where the train is coming at the screen and everyone in the first theater ducked and covered.
Right, right. And like you have it in your own head, because also one of the digital progressions that I find super interesting is like every innovation in three-dimensional or photorealistic digital art is mind-blowing. Like, you know, you're sitting there as a kid watching Jurassic Park going, oh God, dinosaurs. Oh my God, this is so realistic. And then you go back and you go, I can't believe I like thought that didn't suck. Like you can totally see where that is in it, right? And that change, right? Like, and the question of like, how do you, this is a question of preservation. Like, again, I feel like I should, you know, I'm at the Falcon Foundation. Falcon is amazing. We're preserving all the digits. Yeah. But one of the questions we constantly hit is, how do you recreate it, right? How do you, we give money to an amazing person, Ilya, who does, web archiving and builds those tools. And one of the things he stresses about all the time is like, if you're preserving a web page, Like, how do you preserve this, right? Mm. Like, how would we ever recreate this? Like, and you sort of go, oh, there's a podcast. You go listen to the podcast after we've spoken. The podcast is, I listened to the podcast on Spotify so I'd know what you were like. And it's not this, right? Like you said, you have to go and edit out the pauses and the pops and the liveness of it.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do it? How do you...
And listening to the thing is never going to be able to capture the full... I mean, we can go layers of this, right? It's never going to be able to capture the full experience of watching it. It's never going to experience... You're never going to be able to experience, you know, seeing the chat develop in real time and interacting with it. You know, you'd never be able to capture our experience of having this conversation for the first time.
Right.
You know, by the time I edit that podcast, I've had the conversation. I know, you know, where there are lulls. I know that, you know, Colborn's cat has made lots of noise in the background, and... I can recognize those audio signatures. The surprise gets taken out of it.
So one of the things that we first hit when we were talking to people like the Internet Archive. So the Internet Archive does amazing, sterling work, saving everything, and you've got to go and support them because they're being sued to shit by just people who you know want to keep control of the past. Anyway, we work with Brewster and the Archive a lot. And when we were talking to other people about storing data, you know, one of the things that I felt was transformative is, so part of the work that they do is they, in fact, they're being sued about it, is preserving old 75 records, right? Mm-hmm. So is it 75, 72? Because vinyl does have a sell-by date, right? It is decaying. Every time you play it, it raises it. And so they're trying to digitize all of this stuff. So part of their work is digitizing it. The question is always, like, to what fidelity do you digitize things, right? Mm-hmm. Because the thing that the previous age and lack of abundance was about, where am I going to store this? Like, it's like, you know, a terabyte of data or whatever. And I think some of the insight is, like, don't make a decision. Like, store it fucking all, right? Like, keep everything. That's what we got to do. We got to keep everything and let, you know, future generations pick through that. Because mm-hmm. like archaeologists, you know, archaeologists sometimes just go, we're not digging that up because we'll fuck it up. Like, mm-hmm. we're not good enough to excavate this. We're just going to keep it buried, because future generations will know how to analyze this. And I feel that led about the digital world. I'm like, we shouldn't have to make it. We don't have the right.
We don't have the context.
To decide what should and shouldn't go in that collection. And we shouldn't have to, right? Like, we, you know, some people see, I think one of the curses of this moment is people see data as a knowledge and information as a burden, right? Mm. They've seen 4chan, right? Like, they've seen the dark side of the internet, and they're like, okay, I never want to see that again. And people talk very vividly about going, oh, it was a mistake, right? Like, you know, we shouldn't, we've seen too much. We can't unsee this. I'm like, our job is not always to see all of this stuff. Our job is to, like, keep this so that someone else might be able to make sense of it.
There's something so interesting in what you said, which is, you know, you preserve everything, and not just on it for a, you know, defensive purpose, but also for, like, an offensive purpose, in terms of, like, speaking truth to power. So I'm pulling a quote of yours from Mastodon, which is, you know, quote, are we all down with public figures being able to remove the public history of their past statements from the Internet Archive?
Right.
And I read that, and I was thinking about a piece, Colborn, that you turned me on to from Nino Artero, Shitty Art from 2020, which basically immortalizes this Jimmy.eth tweet, or I'm not sure if it's a tweet or something, but it says...
It was a tweet.
The tweet, it says, I really wish you would all shut the fuck up about businesses who have platforms on blockchain not being fully decentralized. No fucking shit, Sherlock. You can make your own smart contracts to sell your shitty art that no one wants anyways. If you have the ability or money to do so, then your shitty fucking art no one wants will be decentralized. The piece is called Shitty Art, and the piece is about, you know, I would never have come in contact with this facet of this person's personality. That's just a little bit of history that was preserved because this artist decided to use and then I guess, remix and repurpose that thought and, you know, take power from it instead of being denigrated by it. And, you know, Colborn, you were like the patron saint to me for talking about the joy of trash art and its ability to capture these fleeting, very, very fleeting moments, these very fleeting interactions. And I just find that so interesting that you can use this preservation intentionally or not to keep records, you know, keep receipts of everything people have done, good and bad, so they can't just escape into the future and hope that like the wave of, you know, internet commentary thereafter is going to end up like protecting them. And we've seen that time and time again with people dredging up, you know, old tweets, old posts from all sorts of individuals who probably should have thought a little bit more about what they were putting online in perpetuity. But I don't know. I mean, like, am I reading that situation right, Danny? Like,
I don't admit, but like, I definitely feel like the ramifications of keeping everything hard to wrap your head around. And so you had this period where like it was just a default instinct to go, like, every removal of data was like a tragedy. And the geeks are basically pack rats, right? Or like, you know, like, you want to keep everything. And part of my job, I used to work at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and you know, one of the consequences of that was the EFF is like they continue to fight against censorship, against surveillance. If you know all the Ed Snowden story and stuff like that, EFF plays an important role in that. So part of my job there was that I would go around to like web admins and people at these companies and try and persuade them not to collect everything on everybody. And it was literally, you would go to Google in 2005 or whatever, and they were going, oh yeah, we're saving every search that people do. And we're going, that's really not a good idea, right? That's going to come back and bite you on the ass. And they're going, no, it's great. We get to like improve people's spellings because we can say, did you mean this? And you're going, the NSA is coming for you, brother. And so, you know, there was a sense in which, okay, collecting everything and losing control of what is collected was going to have these dark consequences. Mm. I think then there was a sort of shift where you had things like the right to be forgotten, right? Where people went, no, I should have the right to like to control this, right? If I search for my name and the third entry is something that my abusive spouse like leaked about me, then fuck that. That should go, right? And I am very sympathetic to that, right? And there've been huge damaging consequences to it. But sometimes the thing that you want comes with an implementation that itself can escape, right? But so that idea of like, okay, there's something out there and I need it to go away, right? First of all, that's very hard to do in a determined way, right? But secondly, if you did have that power, like, you're basically rewriting history, right? Like, you can, you know, you the more we digitize, the more that becomes one of those moments where everything is you can rewrite history. So I think we've gone a little, we experienced the consequences of preserving everything, and now we're experiencing the consequences of people trying to take that power to delete things. Mm. And so now I think we're shimmying into a new world, which is where we do store everything, but we think very thoughtfully about what the consequences of that are.
Hmm. This reminds me quite a bit of something we've talked about a ton on this podcast. We devoted an entire, you know, episode to kind of analyzing a Cypherpunk's manifesto, which was Eric Hughes' text,
right? Yeah,
in 1993, just like super important, and which, you know, I'm going to say a quote from, because for anyone that isn't aware, you should like definitely look into this text. It says, privacy is necessary for an open society in the electronic age. Privacy is not secrecy. A private matter is something one doesn't want the whole world to know. Privacy is the power to selectively reveal oneself to the world. Privacy essentially being choice. And we're kind of talking now around this like gray area, right? Do you have the power, if you have revealed yourself to the world, to unreveal yourself, right? Do you have the power to go back? Does Jimmy.eth have an opportunity? Should he have an opportunity to have believed and announced one belief about himself or themselves and then take it away because it no longer represents them? Colburn, I'm curious your opinion on this like gray area. Like, at what point do we allow people to take away the parts of themselves that they've already been like chosen to reveal essentially? Like,
well, I mean, I think look, I'll be the first to say, of course, people are fallible, and you know, what they reveal in public, they can certainly retract later. I think, you know, they should have the option. But at the same time, it's kind of nice that people are held accountable in this public forum. And if you choose to present yourself and put yourself out there in that way, that it is there and people can remember this about you. I think we've seen numerous examples in politics where people have made outlandish statements that either have or haven't surprisingly come back to hurt them. You know, I hope Jimmy has seen the light at the end of the day.
You know, we were talking the other day about Pablo Frail and the crypto art is dead tweet that, you know, everyone kind of picked up on and felt very powerfully anti about, and kind of turned him into a shithead figure for at least the, you know, present moment. I'm going to try and land the plane on what is a relatively complex thought, but like that moment lives on in the memory, even if the tweet goes away, right? Even if the sentiment isn't preserved, people will remember because they saw it, right? And it was revealed to them. And that's somewhat unintentional, right? We don't get to police what people have seen, what people have experienced, and then their perspective on that thing. But do we get to police the digitized version of that?
So I wasn't super, so I moved to San Francisco in 2000, right? So I was sort of what I felt, or what they felt, was sort of the tail end of the cypherpunks meetups. Like, I went to a few and everyone's kind of going, oh, the golden age is gone, which is sort of hilarious now, right? So I got to meet Eric Hughes and those people. And I when Eric died, like, the only thing I could say was he was one of the few people I know that could say Congress critters and Republicrats in like this real like true venom. And like, they were all these very consequentialist like libertarians, in the sense that, you know, your secrecy depended on you keeping your key, right? And if you lost your key, well, you just have to live with the consequences of those actions, right? And that thread goes through the very engineering of crypto, right? It's the thing that everybody kind of rubs against and goes, like, we will never make this mainstream if it's true that, like, the moment you release your key, everything gets unfurled. And other people going, but that's it. Without your key, like, that's the thing. And it's a very unnatural thing, a pose, but it's a very digitally native pose to have, right? It's the idea that you can keep things private until they're public, right? And then after that, there's nothing that you can do. And in many ways, like, what we're trying to do is work out what that means for us as humans, to live in a world with that sharp edges, with that kind of law of the mathematical jungle out there. You know that everybody, particularly artists, maintain this world of what they, their secret world, the world of their group chats, as it were, right? And the public arena. And then sometimes there's revelations, right, in each ways, that the contradiction gets played out. And this goes to preservation, right, as well. Like, okay, so what if we preserve everything that's public? What do we, I'm on a million group chats that now have disappearing messages. And tis in the rain, right? But the other thing that I know, and I'm constantly telling people with my, like, cypherpunk hat on, disappearing messages doesn't mean anything. Like, that stuff, like, if you have backups, if you run Time Machine on your Mac and you also use Telegram on your Mac or whatever, that database is being stored, right? Like, there's a snapshot and then it's deleted on your phone or whatever, but that snapshot preserves it. And that's going to be the juicy stuff for the archaeologists of the future, right? But it means that you've never escaped that that sense that like the thing that we try to create, which is this transitory moment that is just between us, right? It doesn't really exist except accidentally. Like the only things that disappear are the things that you briefly don't care about long enough for them to go forever.
Or the things you designate initially to disappear.
But that's not true, right? Like if something's important enough, it stays around. Like I know there are people, you know, you say something that like you mean as a throwaway shitpost, right? And in the back of your head, you're going, wow, I hope nobody screenshotted that. Because that's going to add to my receipts. But the more important something is in a different axis to the stuff you want to keep, right? There's something else that's out of your, that's always going to be out of your control about what's preserved and what's not.
One of the things that, that you've said that really interests me, and I can't remember exactly where I'm pulling this from, so forgive me, but you said a decentralized internet is only meaningful if it's adopted and adapted by the people furthest from the centers of power. And one of the, you know, the sentence I probably say most on this podcast is, I don't have an answer for this, but, right? And I think it's really important to kind of just introduce concept, introduce problem A, and then kind of just let people, yeah, myself included, just chew on it, right?
Yeah.
So you founded this, the Open Rights Organization in 2005. And one of the things, correct me if I'm reading this wrong, that you felt was important was not just fighting for certain digital freedoms, but identifying what those freedoms are and why they're important, and then, yeah, making people aware of that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I was just going to say, like, how do you get, this conversation is pretty, you know, out there and maybe not advanced necessarily, but it's like, you know, have to connect the chains to get to the decentralization and preservation as a good, as a bad, as a public good versus as a public service, right? How do we get all these fringes of the internet to buy into the conversation around decentralization, preservation, like all of these issues that I don't think we all have answers for yet, but are at least like trying to litigate?
Yeah, you have to feel it, right? I know that sounds really trite, but so Eric Hughes and John Gilmore, like I kicked up like the Wikipedia is on my other page and it says, you know, along with Tim May, who used to live in a dome, and John Gilmore, and John Gilmore founded EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, which was kind of the inspiration for the Open Rights Group, which is the sort of UK version of it. And the reason why those groups were founded in the late 80s, I guess, 90s, before even me, was that they were early users of the early internet. And so they got a vision of what it was, the way it was going to go. And in some ways, like that was a very long-term vision. Like the reason why people keep going back to the cypherpunks is that was really in a series of, you know, meetups in a room in San Francisco where they went, okay, public key encryption, like what's the consequences of that? And they went all the way down to like, you know, basically saying, well, there will be a digital currency and, you know, this will, and anonymity will do this. And, you know, in some ways that's because those people were like profoundly smart and in the right place at the right time and had the right share of knowledge. But in a lot of ways, it was just because they were already using it, right? And the moment that they did that, the, you know, you suddenly go, oh shit, this means this and this. Open Rights Group started maybe in 2005, and the big conversation in the early 2000s, as you may recall, was about copyright, right? Was Napster, file sharing, is it going to destroy art? Is it going to liberate art? The answer is somewhere in between. But like, big battle over that. And there were no answers, right? Like literally, like I would be in the same situation as you are now where I'm going, people going, but this means people will just be able to make a million copies of a track, like spend it around for free. That's, what do you, how are you going to do art then? And you go, I don't know, but it's going to happen. Like, you know, like I don't have a solution. Same with AI right now, right? Like I'm sitting there and people going, but this is outrageous. These things will scoop up everything and like create their own art. Like what are we going to do about that? I don't know, but the response is not to go, oh, these are stochastic parrots, or, oh, they'll never create real art, or they'll never get the hands right. I was talking to brilliant artist, Hugh Dandrade, who does EFF's art. And if you go to EFF.org, you'll see their art is perfect. And he was going, yeah, all my friends are like, oh, it's okay, they can't do hands. And like, he's just going, that's not the line that you can draw. Like, they're going to be able to do hands pretty soon. And what that comes from is living in that environment, right? And so, and that's what I love about like kind of the crypto and the Web3 and the NFT world, right? Is from the outside, people are extremely critical because, you know, it's just a mess. And they're like, ugh, I don't want to be anything to do with this. And you're going, okay, I understand that. But by doing that, you're missing something about the future of art. And by doing that, like you're sort of, it's not that you're missing out, but like there's a thing that you're not getting.
Well, it's participation, right? You don't get a chance to at least like throw even a momentary opinion, even a momentary action into the grand cauldron of this bubbling, you know, potion figuring itself out, right? And like what it's going to look like at the end.
There's definitely that, right? But even a sort of passive involvement, to give like one of the theoretical things that you sort of talk about, right? Like, digital rights management, DRM, really big thing to fight about. Geeks still fight about it now, like locking down software, you know, like the big discussion with NFTs where like, oh my God, you can right click, you know, blah, blah. That was like the most niche geek. Like we were constantly going, this is a civil liberties issue, right? This is a human rights issue. And people going, you mean like the lock on like, you know, an iTunes song, like, or that you can't like screenshot a Netflix video? What? That's a human rights issue. And it's about control. And I can do my Cory Doctorow impression and rant about it, right? But the key thing I want to talk about is the moment when that became a thing was there was a thing called the Sony rootkit, where Sony had CDs and you used to be able to rip CDs very easily. Steve Jobs would say rip, burn, mix, right? Sony put out these CDs that would, when you put them into a computer, because that's what you did, I guess, they would secretly run a program that would take over your computer, like a rootkit, to make sure that you couldn't copy that CD. And that's what you had to do. Like, that's what Sony had to do to reassert the control that they were used to. They had to take over your computer. Suddenly everyone got it, right? Suddenly everyone, they're doing what the fuck? And you see that same, it seems like a leap, but you know that thing where people are, I have a friend who's freaking out right now because of moving, getting PayPal accounts canceled for like dumb reasons, right? You mention Palestine, and suddenly you're shut down because they're worried that you might be ferrying money to Hamas, right? And there's a world of people who go, oh, this is so annoying. I guess I need to open up another email account. And there are people going, this is really serious. And the people who think it's really serious are the people who've messed around with Bitcoin in the day, right? And they're like going, how do I explain?
Quick digression, but in like 2018, I got my Venmo account shut down because I was paying my friend for dinner and said it was like for the supreme glory of our leader, Kim Jong-un.
Right.
And I no longer had access to my right. Venmo account. I had to like prove that I was not actually affiliated with the North Korean dictatorial state.
Right. And on one level, that's funny, right? And like, you know, we would at EFF, there's a brilliant person who should get on the show to talk about this a bit called Rainey Reitman. And Rainey, it was the person who was really turned on to financial privacy, partly because she worked at the Freedom of the Press Foundation and with WikiLeaks, with the blockade against WikiLeaks, suddenly went, wait, you can just like take away anybody's ability to make money at the drop of a hat. And like on one level, it's funny because I'm pretty sure everybody has done that thing of going, This is for the pot, ha ha ha, right? And then suddenly gone, wait, they're what? I'm blocked. On the other hand, like, it's the consequences, you know, like you sit and you think about it and go, wait, that's really bad.
But so, you know, the undercurrent of this whole conversation has been decentralization, right? Even back when we were talking, when I was like invoking StumbleUpon and Omegle, right? Yeah. Taking you to different sites where that doesn't happen now because it all takes place on these like internal engines, right? You're not going to different sites. You're going to different Twitter pages and you're seeing different versions of the internet through, you know, the eight big sites that we all use. And talking about like these messaging apps that we all use, right? The Venmos, the Zelles, these payment apps, the PayPals that are, you know, there's only three of them. So they're able to assert control because they know that there's nowhere else for us to go. And you've spoken a ton about like the need to re-decentralize everything. The initial question I was going to ask you was like, do you feel like we're moving further away or closer to the kinds of decentralization we need to? Things that like crypto art specifically has always kind of championed. But you know, to me, it seems like it's a zero sum game. You know, it's like with Sony and ripping files. You know, every advancement towards decentralization that we take on the fringes, the center is going to, you know, consume a little bit more of whatever we have not locked up behind us. Right? It's like it's this game of like taking two steps ahead and then being pulled back and being overtaken by someone who's taken one giant step ahead.
I think that the thing. The experience, right? The thing that makes me and anybody who's been involved in a decentralized project, right? Or thing, right? Like that little bit of you that's going, what about StumbleUpon? What about that, right? Like there was a thing then and there isn't now. One of the things that stays with you is that sense of autonomy, right? That sense of control that I am running this machine, right? And it's not running me. And I think that comes also down to like, I get very up and down about this. Like some days I'm like, yeah, like we're gonna like break down the world's like Google, fuck you. And sometimes I'm like, oh shit, like this is unusable. And like, I'm never going to be able to get my friends onto like Mastodon, whatever. And it's very, you know, manic cycles. And I think that's one of the things about autonomy is that things change really quickly. I was talking to Evan, he's going to kill me because I always mangle his surname. But Evan, I'm going to look just to get it right. But Evan invented ActivityPub, which is the, I mean, lots of people invented it, but he has the best claim to like being the person who started everything. And Evan was going, the thing, and we were being kind of depressed old men about like, how are we going to be able to get all this going? And he said, the thing that people really don't remember is how quickly it can change. Right, we've been in this weird stasis moment where like Facebook has kind of aged with us, you know, it's just been there. You know, it's a feeling that things have slowed down, like StumbleUpon and stuff like this was like, stuff happening all the time. And then there's just this dead weight on the whole system. And the thing that feels is you have nothing, you can't change anything, it's all going to be the same and then you'll die. And like, it's not true, right? Things can change like that. And sometimes that happens in bad ways, right? And like there's, but no one can deny that even though there's that dead weight around, I think people know that things can change really quickly. And again, the experience that everybody's had in like the NFT world and the crypto world is like, there are some people for whom 2016 was yesterday, right? Like they're like, you know, oh yeah, nothing really happened. I mean, COVID happened, right? And there are people in the Web3 crypto world who were like, I lived 18 lives. Like I've seen things you wouldn't believe. And change at that speed is terrifying. And that's some of the anxiety of the Weltanschauung, right? The world's experience right now, the accelerationist, right? But you need some velocity to be able to change things, right? You need some sense that you're going to be able to bank this way and bank that way.
You guys ever play Sonic the Hedgehog? You guys know what I'm talking about. So,
I've dabbled. I believe the young people sometimes.
For anyone watching who doesn't know Sonic, so you're like running, right? You're this hedgehog, you're running really fast, and then you hit these checkpoints, right? And these checkpoints are like speed boosts, and that makes you go even faster. And like, you know, you're maintaining this constant velocity and these events that just completely like change the speed at which you even thought you, like, you're just continuously, the upward limit does not exist. And, you know, Colborne, I'm sure you're probably the best equipped to talk about this, but like AI post the ChatGPT boom, right? Watching it from both the museum collection perspective and also the 01 perspective, when suddenly, you know, at the beginning, when I first was using 01, when it first came out, it's like a lot of art, it's all different styles. And then over time, as people become more comfortable with the functionality, as the AI tools at a new velocity continue to become, you know, more prolific, easier to use, suddenly, you know, the every platform is flooded with AI everything. AI is inflecting everything. AI is touching everything. And that's one of the reasons, like, the first question I asked you about preservation, like, I want to see what the trends in artistry, what was being made, what was being collected, what was being curated, what drew people's attention, what that was the day before ChatGPT released, and then every day thereafter. What was it, June 2nd when people got it and suddenly all that started to like fly upwards? Or was it directly after ChatGPT? Was it sometime, you know, in the fall, like after 01 was released, when people realized that these tools were accessible and really powerful?
So, yeah.
Please, you look like
I'm like, you're always going, Colbert, what do you think? And I'm like, don't screw Colbert. I got an opinion.
That's why you're here. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, very classic experience, my experience, right, of this, because I'm like Zelig, really. I'm like in the background of all of these things. Like, you're sort of going, oh, yeah, the cypherpunks, and there's all these giants, and there's me in the background, like, eating the vol-au-vent or whatever in the background.
The donuts and the coffee.
Yeah, the donuts, the guy going, interesting. So with GPT, I was at EFF. You can check this. I'm not just name dropping, right? And the first paper came out about GPT. And what was significant about that, or GPT-2, was they were like, here's what it can do, but we're not going to release it. It's too dangerous. It's, you know, and, you know, they saw it, right? They played around with it. They got that experience. They went, holy shit, like, this is just going to cause spam and misinformation and all of these things. And we wrote at EFF a piece going, no, that's not how you move on. This is not how science progresses. And, like, you know, in the balance between hoarding stuff and being open, being open has better results for society. And it's a position, right? I mean, I am an advocate for that position, but I completely understand the other side. And, like, we went and had a dinner with, like, OpenAI people, and they invited a bunch of, you know, bio-warfare people and, like, nuclear proliferation people who were very good at arguing the other side, where they were, like, going, yeah, occasionally we'll come up with the, you know, anthrax virus, and we don't publish that. Do you want us to? Good point. But in the end, OpenAI did the thing. And this is what's funny, is the reason why ChatGPT has that form is they went, you know what? The safest way for us to do this is just to centralize it, and you can log in and use our GPT, and we won't share it with anyone. And I was like, oh, that's the beginning of the end. I genuinely was. I was like, because that's like going, I'll just keep the ring for myself. I'll have this Silmaril. And, like, don't worry, I'll look after it. But I, you know, I wanted the ring for myself too. So I blagged a really early account. And I went, oh, I'm from the EFF, and we want to experiment with, you know, AI safety. And got it, right? Like, I spent the next 6 months going, it's, oh shit, something's coming, right? And I'm not sure that that was useful in many ways, right? I mean, it's just my intellectual greed And the fact that, like, you get that chance one in a, you know, a few times in a lifetime. But it goes back to this thing, right? Of like, you need the people who are there experiencing it to have some insight. And if you want the world to deal with the consequences of this, in many ways, you just have to let them see it, right? Mm.
Well said. One of the first people I met at the museum was this artist and kind of AI expert named Curran 4D. And I remember very early on, I was writing pieces about, like, little bits of criticism about all the pieces in our Genesis collection. And he's like, I have this model, and what we're going to do is we're going to take all your writing and we're going to feed it into this model, and it's going to be able to produce criticism just like you write. And I was like, mind blown, couldn't believe it. There's no way this thing is pop. And I, like, 3 months later, he showed me an output and it got my style. And I was like, this is the beginning of the end. And now it's like taking on back. Of course you can do that. Like, yeah, I could do that. I rewrote the Lord of the Rings with Dr. Seuss.
Right.
I was like 1:30 in the morning.
The original OpenAI thing had a really weird contract where it said you can use this, but you can't share, like, you can't make a connection to it. It was really unclear. And also, I thought they were going to throw me off it because, to be honest, like, I was just, you know, me and my friends were just making it pump out, like, you know, Elon Musk screenplays and things, rather than seriously analyzing its AI safety consequences. And so I was occasionally posting stuff to Facebook, and people just wouldn't believe me. People would just go, I said, you know, it was that an AI wrote this thing moment, you know, when people were going, oh, I did this and an AI wrote it. And people were going, you fucking wrote it. And it was like, first of all, what a weird own, right? Like, I'm going, aha, I secretly wrote a perfect parody and then told you it was an AI. But also, like, I was going, no, really, this is a machine did this. And please wrap your head around this, because it's and wrap around, like, the positive consequences as well as the negative consequences. Again, to name drop, because that's, I'm just a living name dropper these days. So in my Living on the Dole in the UK writing comedy years, it was me, a bunch of other very poor, grubby people, and Charlie Brooker, who did Dark Mirror. Charlie used to do cartoons for computer magazines. That's where he got his start. And I mean, completely correct that Charlie, the world recognized Charlie's skills. But sometimes I think people think, they go, oh, this is, oh, we can't do that because remember what happened in Dark Mirror? And I'm going, it's a story. it's like going, oh, do you remember what happened in, you know,
yes, like, remember what happened in The Godfather? Never get your son involved in the family business.
Right. Do you remember what happened in Cinderella? I'm not sure that you should, like, you know, have a baby shower. And there are stories that we can tell about the future, but they're stories. And their primary value is in them being stories, not about them being predictions. And again, that is what comes back to this world that you live in. Like, there's a difference between how NFTs present themselves to the outside world, right? Like, how the sort of, you know, the attitude and the shitpostery and the shittiness of the art, right? Like, you know, and people are going, oh, it's just monkeys. And you're going, yeah, but that's part of the deal, right? That's an artifact of a very complicated thing that people are inhabiting. And I don't know, because, like, obviously you only live one life, right? Like, you can't, like, although I feel like I have flipped from, like, one thing to another. But again, maybe the consequence, maybe that's what true art does and true history does, is it lets you live someone else's life so you can see that and you can see those consequences.
I think that's a really great nugget of wisdom, and we're nearing an hour mark, so maybe we should let the wisdom just sing out a little bit on its own. Colborne, any last words you want to say before we
I mean, I feel like we gave no context for the episodes. I want to definitely like shout out Internet Archive, EFF, go support those incredible organizations. The reason we're here with Filecoin today is because they were super generous to provide us with a grant to back up not only everything in our permanent collection, but everything in our community collection, which includes the works that you upload. And also all of the curation states inside of the rooms that we have. So imagine your room, your 3D metaverse architecture that you fill with art. You can be the first to claim that you showed this artist then, and you can explore that room over time with Filecoin as you would the Internet Wayback Machine, which is just incredible. It speaks to the ability of the curator to highlight and lift to the art that's being created itself. And go on, Denny.
Bring us your data, right? Like, so that I work at the Filecoin Foundation, the whole idea, the way IPFS was engineered, the way Filecoin was engineered was to create a permanent repository for the world's most, humanity's most important information, to which I would extend everything is important. So, and you know, we have the crypto economic incentives to do that. And like, we just want more data. We just bring us your NFTs, bring us everything, put it on IPFS. And like, let's keep this stuff so it will outlast the centralized shit storm that we have now, and we'll live forever in the glorious decentralized future.
Yeah, I got too distracted by the joy of this conversation.
Oh, me too. Like, I'm so bad at like plugging it. I was like, oh yeah, and that what came to you from Filecoin.
We love Filecoin. We appreciate Filecoin. Preserve your shit, because you know, parroting the great art gnome, like, it's not safe if it's not backed up, and if you don't know where it's backed up, then it might as well not be backed up.
And make lots of backups, lots of copies, keep stuff safe.
Yeah, get an external hard drive and lock it in a vault somewhere, and then take the key to that and lock it in another vault, and then use a passcode on that first vault and remember your password.
You know, can I know we're kind of the natural wrap-up thing, but I'm going to push back about that. Make a million copies. Don't, like, it's not the safety bit. It's not like the I'm going to put this in a thing and I'll put it in a thing, because so one of the reasons we work with the Internet Archive has a store of everything on the internet. No one else did that. It's on the San Andreas fault. we're like desperately backing it up, and you know, with the archive's help, because the more copies you make, and this is why IPFS works the way it is, it's not like there's one permanent copy somewhere out in IPFS, it's you can have a million copies. So that's what you should do.
Yeah, make a million copies of this now. Bury them all over the ground and leave a set of treasure map codes all cut up and give one to each,
like,
of your
squirrels design. Yeah, right? Exactly. Be a data squirrel.
Well said.
I needs workshopping. Like,
gentlemen, at risk of me missing anything else important, anything else we want to say before we get out of here? I mean, there's a lot of important things. We should have you back on, Danny, and we should go into this conversation some more. I think we got to like four of my 10 questions.
We didn't even talk about the SEC Twitter account compromise thing, which I love.
So funny.
Like, Colburn has this on his desktop background. I was just watching that trash fire play out before I logged on, and like, someone's got to keep some copies about that. They deleted one of the tweets, you see?
Yeah.
Key point. There we go.
Well, see, it all comes back to this podcast at the end, and we appreciate everyone who, you know, pulled their eyes away from that dumpster fire to watch this slightly less conflagratory dumpster fire with Danny Colburn and I. This has been the Mocha Live podcast. Thank you all for joining us. If you did like what you heard, please give us a rate, like, subscribe, follow, high five, whatever your platform of choice allows you to do. Please follow our Substack at museumofcrypto.substack.com for writings on all these topics and more. Please give all of us, especially Danny at Mala on Twitter, MALA. A follow. Please check out what Filecoin is doing, and please use all of our cool toys that use Filecoin, because you will fall in love with them just like we have. This has been the Mocha Live podcast. Thanks for sharing it with us, and we'll be back real soon. So long, everybody.
See ya.
A huge thank you to Danny O'Brien for being our guest this week. And just to further highlight the undertone of today's conversation, another huge thank you to Filecoin for the incredible advancements they've allowed the museum to make. Thanks as always to Colburn for being my co-host, to Julian Brangold for composing our intro music, and to Day Fox for composing our cold open theme. I, Max Cohen, edited and produced this podcast, and we would all like to extend the largest thank you to you for listening. We really enjoyed having you with us here for this absolutely scintillating conversation, and we're already looking forward to having you back for the next one. So take care, and thanks once more.